Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening and greetings. Welcome to the Friday Night Shabbat Show. Neither Craig nor JB can be here tonight. I'm Kirk, and I'll be your host tonight. Craig asked me to fill in, and with great trembling, I said, through my wife, she wrote, what? It's kind of, but we did, Terry's, the family IT person, she got us in today and got the program on the air. So we appreciate that very much, and thank you. And I called out to a friend today and asked Dr. Jeff to join me. So he'll be with us tonight. How are you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing fine. Shabbat Shalom, family.
Shabbat Shalom. I'm really delighted that you could join us. And I know a lot of people already know you or through different communications in, among the family. But it's always nice to hear how you came to run across Craig in the translations and how we came to know Yahweh. You want to just tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Sure, I'll do a bulleted presentation and let you know how I came to know Craig. I came in to know Yahweh, like so many of our brethren, through the back door. I was interested in studying Islam in the wake of 9/11 and came across Craig's writing, Prophet of Doom, befriended Craig, and at the time Ken Power, and they had a profound impact on me, the writing and the message they conveyed, and the truths that were conveyed in the writing. Once the truth about Islam became more and more obvious, our conversations evolved, and we start speaking about what I refer to at the time as scripture. I was not religious. I was, in fact, I detested religion. I was raised as a secular Jewish person in the Northeast and had been heavily influenced, even though I was not religious, by Rabbinic Judaism. Needless to say, after a short time, I began to learn about Yahweh, Yahusha, Torah, and the corruptions of Pauline Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism, and the beauty of Yah's message took foundational hold, and it's been a piercing, white-hot light within me, with much thanksgiving to that interest being flamed and spurred on by Craig, who continues to feed so many of us by his prolific work. It's been now since 2003, 15 years that I know Craig, and the family that we belong to, the Covenant family, is very, very precious, very, very special, and I like everyone values it immensely. It's priceless, and it's been a treat, delight, to know everyone and to continue to know everybody and to learn about everybody. And I feel it's an honor and that I've been asked to just participate. And I hope I'm more of a supportive cast than someone who interferes, because you've become a great teacher, Kirk, and your contribution, and Harry's contribution.
I'm a mediocre sidekick at the best, but
not at all. No, you're a great asset, the different angles and points of view that you convey. I call your specialty with the pictorial interpretation of Hebrew, which down to Yah's name is a foundational principle which girds us and forms a core key understanding, you know, mm-hmm. with our ability to reason and make sense of Yah's message, which is conveyed in the Torah prophet and the Psalms. But that's the story on me, and we're called out to edify and magnify and amplify Yah's message while doing the opposite to messages which contradict his message and distort his message and misrepresent his message. And I know we all take that very, very seriously, and I know that tonight's show you've put a great deal of work into, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say, Kirk.
Well, this is an honor to have you. I really appreciate you being here. And, you know, a couple of people, Terry told me there's a few people in the chat room that wanted to know whether you were a real doctor, so maybe you ought to just tell them what kind of doctor you are.
Yeah, I'm a real doctor. I'm a pulmonary critical care physician. Specialize in pulmonary, which deals with the lungs and the chest, diseases of the chest. And I deal with people who are very, very sick, who tend to end up in ICUs and not be in great shape when they hit the ER or the intensive care unit. But, yes.
So you're about the last doctor I want to see, right?
That's exactly right. And I will let you all know the best advice I can give you all is if you want to stay healthy, please stay away from doctors.
What a promoter you are.
One of the great monikers implicates and deals with healing. The name, you know, name Raphael or Raphael.
Mm-hmm.
Yah is our healer.
Yeah.
Invokes healing profession.
Yeah.
But let's everybody stay healthy and be well. But and if there's anything I can do ever to help anybody or provide information or anybody who's in need of anything of a medical nature and I can be of assistance, please don't hesitate to contact me.
Well, you know, I find most of the people, just about everybody I've met in this family is, they're all very diverse in their knowledge of different things and their abilities, but they're all terribly nice, and you are among them. So, thank you once again.
Thank you for those kind words.
Yes, sir. Well, you know, what I set aside for us a very small task tonight, I thought that we might just destroy the notion that Christianity and by the same token another rabbi-inspired myth called rabbinical Judaism, we could prove that it was truly not valid nor it is totally corrupt. So to begin with, but before we do, the one interesting thing that you find immediately about rabbinical Judaism and Christianity is God's name. None of them use it. They both begin with the premise that Yahweh, the name, is too holy, too, we should have been set apart, but is too special to use, yet he writes it, as you know, 7,000 times throughout the Torah, Proverbs, and Psalms. Paul ignores it altogether. Of course, some of this most of you know, but for maybe some of the newer people, Jesus Christ was an invention. In the Greek, it became Aousos, the name of Jesus. Yahusha was his name, but they called him Aousos or Aousun. And the closest thing we have to what that means is that it would be the name of Zeus, a pagan god. He's also called as a title Christo. Christo means, one of its main meanings is to be drugged or the application of drugs. So we've got a title for Yahusha, diminished manifestation of Yahweh, as a drug dispenser, or he's called to name Zeus, but and to go to add more injury, more insult, Paul characterizes him as Dionysus, the Greek god. So those things are so disgusting to me, so horrible to me, that I thought we might address some of those. And one of the things I wanted to do is, those are not his name. His name is Yahweh. And I was going to start out with how that is written. Now, you mentioned that I really enjoy and study ancient Hebrew lettering. And the reason I did that, Jeff, early was because of something that Yahusha said in the translations in Matthew, and hopefully we can get to that tonight, where he said, don't change a jot or a tittle. And right before we came on air, we were talking about that, how disgusting it is on the actual Hebrew language or alphabet has been changed about three times. You have the ancient Hebrew, and you've been really good to Karen out by sending information all the time from different sources that I read, where they're discovering more and more the oldest language, Hebrew, and the oldest alphabet, of course, is the ancient Hebrew alphabet that we discuss all the time. It was changed, as you probably know, when Yahweh was fed up with Israelites, and he sent them off to Babylon because they were practicing everything that Babylon was practicing. So when they came back with a slightly different alphabet, and that's usually considered by most of the books that I read, they call that Paleo-Hebrew. It's very close, but it's a little more angular because they were writing on clay tablets instead of papyrus and so forth.
Papyrus.
Papyrus, yeah. So, so it kind of morphed into that, and then later it became more boxy. And then the fourth incarnation is when the rabbis use the vowel points. Well, the only reason to use the vowel points is to get you to mispronounce everything important. I mean, it's got five vowels. You don't. There's nothing. You got to talk very plainly without any extra vowel help. So you certainly didn't need it there.
Absolutely right, Kirk. And what I find appalling, as you find appalling, and it really hurts my sensibilities, is the two most profound names in the universe, Yahweh and Yahusha. And, you know, the Father's name should be, and the Son's name should be minimized or trivialized, is absolutely offensive. And as we will discuss later, as per our discussions earlier, we speak about what's mistakenly called commandments, Ten Commandments. You read the first three, and you see on those stones the emphasis on the name and the relevance of the name and the penalty that you can face if you ignore the name, minimize the name, trivialize the name, downplay the name, hide the name. It's mortifying.
Yeah. God takes this really serious. This is, you know, if you think about it and go back to the ancient Hebrew, which is, I like for that reason, because I like to go back to the source, just like we go back to as far as we can with the Dead Sea Scrolls and the ancient pictographic things that we find in archaeology and so forth. And when we don't have anything of the New Testament that's in Hebrew, there's probably a reason for that. Yahweh said his Torah is complete, we don't need it, but it's historical evidence and certain things it is nice to have. But we do have some stuff. I'll be reading from the Papyri 46, which is the oldest Greek manuscript copy of Matthew and Yah, gift from Yah, is what Matthew means. But just a quick note on the letters. It's such a beautiful word, Yahweh. It's got, it starts out with a yod. Now, in modern Hebrew, it is the thing that Yahshua was alluding to is this stupid little comma they make to represent a yod, when a yod is a hand reaching down from heaven, reaching across, and the palm, and the hand is actually open to receive us or to help us, to lift us up. So you have Barak, or the blessing, or lifting up, NASA, lifting us up, and start out with his name. You have the Hay. A Hay is a man standing up. He is beholding something. That's like when we say Hay, to behold, to look in with expectations and see something glorious. So you have a man standing up, and his legs are apart. He's engaged. He's walking. He's symbolically, you can draw a super duper art piece of art, but you can see that he's moving. He's not standing still. He's not laying down. Next to him,
he's lifting while being he's being lifted up while he's engaging.
While he's engaging, exactly.
What a message! What a
yeah, and that's his first two letters.
That's right.
It just goes on and on and on. But you've got the next one, of course, as you know, is the Wah. And while we use as and, because we're adding more to a sentence, but it is a symbol of a tent peg. You use a tent peg to extend the walls of a tent to anchor it down, to protect it, to hold it in safety, and to make it sturdy, but also to increase it so that you can have a family. And then the final Hay, once again another Hay, but the Hay when it comes, as you know. Is feminine, so it represents a male the first day and a female on the second. So Yahweh's name, by the way, is feminine. If that bothers anybody, then take it up with Yahweh. But is male and female, and as we all pretty much are in agreement with, this is very good, very symbolic, I think, of Abraham and Sarah. And the Wa is the increase. The increase, of course, of their relationship was Yishak and the children that followed. So you have the whole symbol of a family being lifted up by Yahweh from above. And all of that is lost when you change all the letters. And that's a crime to me. So
I agree. It is a crime. It's an absolute crime. And for any religious authority to speak with pomposity and arrogance and hubris about how it's not important, how it can't be pronounced, how it's ineffable, how, quote-unquote, God has many names, what matters is what's in our heart, that's all nonsense. His name is his essence. And I'm very glad that you're emphasizing this foundational principle and beautiful way using pictorial Hebrew and the symbolism. It's magnificent.
Well, it's like you've got the words, you've got the letters, you've got the grammar, and when you put them all together, you've got such a clear picture that is hard. You cannot twist it unless you just want to lie to somebody. And if they look it up and do the same things, even if you just take a few words at a time, or one word, start with one word. I started with Shamar and Shama. The reason, as I told Craig, I think, the other day, I told him, is because if that means obey, then everything falls apart. It is an old, obey is a made-up word, old Anglo-Saxon word from early English, not Middle English or Late English. I think it goes all the way back to Old English. But it's more of a order. It's not something you do of volition. You are to obey. You obey a order. So it comes from a Lord, and that changes all the context. And obviously, that's why they used it. I have heard. I have not actually looked this up because I don't have one of the larger. There's only a few places you have to go to, like the New York Library, to get a complete English dictionary. But I heard it read one time out about obey, and I think you have to go to about 26 definitions or more before you get to obey as anything that even resembles observation. So I thought that was pretty important, and because that clarifies a ton of things in my mind. And then it was pretty easy to find, and I went from there to using one Strong's lexicon, and now I use about 7 different ones each time so that I get a good cross section. They're quite diverse and go there. So all those things are helpful. I find the letters just as helpful too, and I think it's an introduction to God. I'm pretty sure that you'll find, if you're looking for those letters and the explanation of what each letter means, which is unique in alphabets. I don't know of any other alphabet that also means, consistently means a specific thing. And I don't mean just a picture of a bird like in hieroglyphics, but it actually has a total meaning all to itself. So there's a whole study in there, and it's very verifiable or something you're looking for when you can go to multiple sources. And you brought up, the Marcel, the Proverbs, where they shout their Yahweh's name from the rooftops. Why would you say, my children know my name, and they shout it from the rooftops, if he didn't expect you to use it? Second question may be a rhetorical to you, but why would he write his name 7,000 times, Yahweh, throughout the Torah, Provenance, Psalms, if he didn't want you to? And how did Moshe convey that to him if he wasn't allowed to say it?
That's right. And then you speak of the Mashal, the Proverbs. What does Proverbs 35:6 say?
I'm not sure. Let me what is it?
If you want to look that up, I'm going right go from memory right now.
You can paraphrase.
I can paraphrase. Yeah, I can do that. It speaks of knowing his name and his son's name. Do you know
Oh, yeah, it says, I remember it as what is my name and what is my son's name? Surely you know. Well, I guess
surely
you
know.
Yeah, something else.
You mentioned the Mashal, and it specifically asked that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
why
would you know? How can you greet somebody? I mean, who doesn't know what their father's name is? Come on. Well, if he's a lord and he's a powerful king and you're just a slave, that's a whole other condition. But this is not what Yahweh presents in his Torah. Everything is volitional. Everything is his desire for you to do these things so that you might reconcile with him. And if you twist and keep people from coming to him, then you're in big danger of your soul being obliterated.
You are very big danger.
He's put into Shaul, you know. So on that note, let's go over to, now I'm going to do a little bit of reading, and you know, I wish I had a great voice and that sort of thing, but let me read to you on the first tablet of the two tablets of stone that Yah wrote in this context. This is God talking to us. Specifically, he wrote this. This is not a dictation to Moshe, as most of the Torah became. He's writing with his own finger and his own yod, writing this in stone. He wrote it in stone for the reason that he wanted to be preserved. This is for a permanent record. And he says, and God conveyed all of these statements using and providing perspective in our presence, saying, I am Yahweh. He starts out with, I am Yahweh, and it's spelled Yahweh, your God, your Elohim, who relationally and beneficially brought you out and delivered you from the realm of the crucible of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall not exist with other gods in relation to my presence. Well, even if you didn't read any commentary, even if you don't use an expanded thing, it's very easy to see that he's taken them out of this political, religious, militaristic world called Egypt, Mitzrayim, where they were slaves, and now they're free. And he said, don't go back to that. Why do you want to be enslaved? I mean, I'm paraphrasing, you know, my own thoughts here, but he's taken them from slavery. He's not taking them from slavery so they can be a slave to him. He wants them to be free. He wants them. You can't have volition if you're not free. You can't choose to do something or be part of a family if you're not free. So it's pretty straightforward. And the next verse or the next section of that is, forgive me for flipping a few pages here. You should not continue to associate yourself with a carved image or idol, or any visual representation of something which is in the heavens above, or which is in the earth below, or which is in the waters beneath the land. Now, believe it or not, this was a little bit difficult for me, because as an artist, and especially as an illustrator, I had occasion to draw stories, Bible stories. I knew icons, what a difference between an icon, and I never thought of people looking at this with reverence, but more as a historical note, just picturing costuming and so forth, and here's the story and telling the story. That's what illustrators do. But once I really took that to heart, I burned or tore up everything I had that even resembled anything close to it, because I said, my God, Kurt, don't do it. And the thing that really made me do that was one of my students bought one of my little drawings, and they gave it to their son, and they said, this is an older gentleman, a son, you know, in his 20s, and he said, he looks at that and he just, he's mesmerized by it, and I'm going, hey man, this is just a drawing, and it made me feel awful, you know. So that was it. So I tore up everything I could find that I did, and never went on. So, but the good news is that it is also in the, if you stop doing what you're doing, then Yah will just start over with you. So, but that was,
that's right.
Yeah. He says you should not make, this is very interesting, you should not make a practice of bowing down and worshiping them or speaking for them. You shall not habitually serve them. You know, there's nowhere that I can find the whole Torah where Yahweh said, pray to me. The law is not prayer. By the way, it may be translated that way in your English Bibles, but he didn't say, pray to me. He didn't say, bow down to me. He didn't say, worship me. He didn't say, praise me.
No. No obeying. No compulsion to prayer. No compulsion to praise. Just absolute
that were with Abraham, those were conversations. That wasn't a prayer. That
right.
wasn't somebody on their knees or somebody
right.
begging him to do something for him. He would just say, well, what do you think about this? Or, well, how about this, Yahweh? They were very, the way you would talk to your father, the way you would talk to a friend.
That's right. That's yeah. right.
He didn't say, get on your knees, Barbara. Will you come to me?
You know, that's man-made, rabbinical, from one point of view, Pauline from another point of view, and another tragic thing that's occurred, which we spoke about, is that the messianic movement, whether you come at it from a Jewish, Christian, or Nazarene standpoint, frequently is a toxic concoction and brew of Rabbinic, Akibic Judaism, Pauline, Christianity, and you pursue those type of beliefs and values, you're going to take an accelerated trip to Sheol.
Sheol.
And do untold damage on the way. So it's just these points are very important. I mean, they're foundational as we discussed, but I think it's really important that go over the basics and where you find them in the Torah.
And another thing that we're discussing tonight is in any way conflict with the things that we've been discussing for months and months. The story of the pathway home and how to approach Yahweh and through the story of Abraham and his family is exactly this. This is 500 years later, written by Yahweh, by his own hand, and also dictated through Moshe. Speaking of twisting in the story, it goes on to say, for indeed I, Yahweh, once again he's using his name, your God am a zealous and jealous God, actually counting and reckoning, from Bukhlad, we did that the other day as a translation, and the perversity and sin of twisting and distorting of the fathers upon the children concerning the third and fourth generations of those who are genuinely hostile to me, of those who are actually abhor, detest, and loathe me, literally striving maliciously against me, shunning me. So that's what, if you were going to twist his word, he views you as a person who detests him, and he has nothing to do with you. In fact, he is...
all your children.
Yeah.
And he takes it out in your family.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason, what are your thoughts on this? I think the reason he's talking to the children of Yisrael, his family that he's chosen to be an oracle people. In this particular situation, he's talking about for the third and fourth generation, because he, throughout time, he would send another prophet and so forth and so on to get them back on the correct path. The sad part about this, if you're doing this to your family and you're not, and let's say you're in Europe somewhere or Africa somewhere, it'll never change. It'll go thousands of years. Europe is that way. When the Roman Catholicism took over Europe, it was no chance for generation after generation after generation after generation. And Yahweh didn't promise to send prophets all over the place. That's probably the difference in the 4 years is because he is focusing on his family. What do you think?
That makes sense to me. It's rational.
Yeah.
It's rational.
It may be a lot deeper than that, but what you know, but that's the first thing.
and it's also somewhat it's edifying. But again, but to be passionate about his name, he's passionate about his name, the most important name in the universe, and the symbolism.
The four, you know, it's the fourth generation would be, that'd be another 40 years, another 400 years, another whatever, you know, the four, every time you see something with a 440 or 400, it is a period of testing. So for the days,
yes.
You know, for the flood, so that also has something to do with it as well. So in any case, he's consistent, I mean. But the good part is that he's got some good news that follows this. He says, but I will genuinely act and actually engage to literally prepare, perform, and produce unmerited and unfailing mercy, unearned favor, and undeserved kindness. Paul won't agree with this. On behalf of the thousands, not billions, but on behalf of the thousands who move towards me and love me, and also who approach me by closely, now this is very key here, once again he says, also who approach me by closely observing and carefully considering law shamar, who enter my presence by becoming observant and actually focusing upon thoroughly examining and thoughtfully evaluating my terms and instruction, which is the translation of a mitzvah, the conditions of my covenant, my authoritative directions and codicils, which serve as prescription for my relationship agreement. We have covered that for weeks now with Abraham.
Wow, that's
in the stones. I'll argue with
that should be emblazoned in all of our minds, in our hearts. I mean, that's it. Wow. That is,
yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a tingly, but you need, that's one of the reasons why I think you should at least be familiar with some of the keywords like Shamar and Mitzvah, because this is not just a made up terms of instructions. This is the Mitzvah, and everywhere you go, it says exactly the same thing through every. There's a little bit of commentary which I'd like to read. This is what, for these reasons, this is Craig wrote his commentary, and I thought it was quite good. As most of his stuff is pretty well thought out, but to this I thought it was exceptional. For these reasons, Yahweh warns us about the consequences of distorting, twisting, and perverting his message, something every religion has done. By corrupting his testimony, we condemn our own children as they are exposed to the milieu of religious deceptions. By contrast, God has affirmed in writing that those who shamar, closely observe, carefully examine, and revere his instructions, will, she said, receive mercy, an unearned and undeserved gift.
Now his personal.
Yeah.
That's a key word that you're mentioning there, Kurt.
Chesed, yes.
Or depending on how you pronounce it. And,
well, that's when you get a chet, you know, it can be a CH or an HH, depending on the arrow.
Right.
And you hear a lot is ha and ch, you know, which are used interchangeable.
Unbridled mercy, unearned merit.
Yeah.
Yes. Very key word.
But remember that as a counterpoint to Paul, who said there's no mercy in the Torah. How absurd.
Right. That's right.
I mean, what else can you do but write it in stone by his own hand? No wonder he can't stand it.
One of many things that blows Pauline's message out of the water.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many, but, you know, if you look at his words and question him, his testimony is destroyed.
Yeah. Well, here's the sad part. He went on to say, and he's absolutely correct here, that Yahweh has personally prepared and delivered this gift, and yet his unearned favor and unmerited kindness will be enjoyed by 1 in a million people. That is precisely what thousands among billions convey. And as such, all popular religions have summarily excluded as a means to divine favor. Should you want to be among the few, I'll just finish this and hold your thought there. And should you want to be among the few who will benefit from Yahweh's just said mercy, please note when God etched this advice in stone, there was but one place where his mitzvah, his terms and conditions pertaining to his covenant contract, were written, the Torah. Therefore, according to God, the Torah is his source of chesed, unmerited, undeserved, unearned, and unfailing favor, which leads to a loving relationship with him. I thought it was beautifully written and well
It's beautifully written. The message is simple. It's profound. And it leaves no wiggle room for anything. No doubt. Again, that is like front and center. Those words are just should be seared in all of our hearts. I mean, that it's and it's great that you are quoting them. And yes, Craig did a marvelous job in the way he's stated it. And it's been stated in multiple writings, most recently, Observations for Our Times. Thanks for bringing that up. Thank you.
Certainly. Gosh. As we finish off the Tablet of the Stone, the first one, the rest of them are excellent. But these are the key things, because these are the things that if you go against them, there is no, he will not forgive you violating these things continuously. You know, you can be like all of us, really wrong on the wrong path and get on the right path. But this is not a forgivable offense. He goes on to say, you should not continue to actually deceive or delude through the name or reputation. Now we get into what he feels about what they're doing to his name. Through the name and reputation of Yahweh your God, advancing worthless and lifeless deceptions. For indeed, Yahweh will not forgive or leave unpunished those who consistently deceive, actually beguile, and habitually delude in association with his name. Those who promote and affect vain and ineffectual lies that lead to lifelessness and destruction. There is no wiggle room there.
There is none with no wiggle room there. And, that condemns every religion. That condemns fallen Christianity. It condemns rabbinic Judaism. It condemns them both. It's a done deal.
Yeah. I won't move on to the other one, but the other tablet, although it's wonderful, we'll say that for another time, but that's God speaking directly to us. So I thought that was, I'm trying to get a little snippet of places that people can go and study a little more that I have found have been very inspiring to me. And then before we, hopefully we'll get to Chabuk, if not some other time, but the next one is in Korah, which is called, mistakenly called Leviticus. Korah, called out. What a great name in Leviticus. And that's 18:1 through 5, I believe. So let's go over there and let me see if I have those easily. Yep. And let me read to you what he said through Moshe. He says, speak to the children of Israel, those children who are engaged and endure with God, and say, affirm to them that I am Yahweh, your God, your Elohim. With regards to things which could be considered similar to the practices of the realm of the crucible of Egypt, where you dwelt, you should not engage in or act upon similar pursuits. In the land of the the land of the transliterated into Canaan, which beneficially as a result of the relationship I am bringing you, there you should not act upon or engage in their decrees or customs, or never walk in or follow them. Well, that's pretty plain. You know, he just took them out of Egypt, a place, and took them to the promised land. They didn't want to go in, so he killed off that generation. He wouldn't let them go in after they refused to go in with his help. So the next generation to move in, he's giving them a warning now and saying, look, this, don't turn this land, my Jerusalem, my Israel, into this horrible place that I just took you out of. Why would you want to go back to slavery? In fact, I would say that he took the northern tribes out because they had become Canaanites, Roman Catholics, same religion, almost verbatim. And he took the Yehudim out on two occasions, and one diaspora that exists until 1948 because they had done the same thing. All they had to do was turn to Yahweh. Hezekiah did, and it was turned into a party. Yahweh wiped out the enemy. But he's warning them, don't do that. He says, with my means to exercise good judgment regarding resolutions of disputes, once again, Mishpat, my means to decide regarding justice and judgment, you should continually engage in genuinely act with my prescriptions for living. Carefully consider, once again, you should consistently examine and carefully consider, once again, Shamar, for the purpose of approaching by walking to them, I am Yahweh, your God. What do you think he's referring to when he says walking to them? If it's not the Moed Mikra.
It's basically the path. It's the Torah. All about Torah.
Yeah. Yes, you have to go through Passover, and you have to go through Pesach, you have to go through Matzah and Koram.
That's right. It's exactly right. These are gifts. But
this is now this is rather telling too. To finish this off, this is 18:5. Yeah, he says, and so you should choose of your own volition. Lords of the manor don't say choose of your own volition. They command. They want you to obey their commands. He says, choose of your own volition to actually and completely observe. There's nothing. Just use your eyes, use your senses, think, respond appropriately. Accordingly, my prescriptions for living, and also my means to resolve disputes, which is once again this part. He's my prescriptions for living is Shukwa, my inscribed and thus written instructions, which cut you into the relationship and thus into the covenant with me, and also my means to resolve disputes, which is Mishpat. My means to exercise good judgment regarding redemption, thereby directing our attention to his seven invitations to meet. Whoever over time and as an ongoing process acts upon and engages with them, that man or woman, indeed, that individual, that person, indeed, is actually and completely restored to life as a result of this desire, and his decision living forever through them will be for, through them. I am Yahweh.
Wow. That's so powerful. I mean, the fact that he's imploring us to, of our own volition, please follow his instructions as a power.
The times that's a life. When he says, please, I'm just going, wow.
I mean, it's amazing how much he loves us, that he's giving us all these chances to closely examine and carefully consider.
Take your time to look at what I'm offering. It's not. It's so simple, it's almost, it's amazing. So anybody can do it if they have the desire. You can't give somebody the want to, but if they have the want to, if they can find the ways to the Torah, they'll find the answer.
Well, that's why any anti-Torah message needs to be challenged and exposed, and being anti-Torah is being basically for the plague of death.
Yeah.
It's being for death.
Let me throw in something just because I know a lot of people like to translate now and look up words and all that. And we've been going when we did the introduction to God, Volume 1, on about page 875. That's where I was reading from on the tablet of stone, and then I went to Korah in Leviticus. Korah or Leviticus 18, and that was on page 592 in the book of Question in Paul. Then I thought we might go on to, now we've heard it from Yahweh's very own tablet. We've heard it from the Torah written from dictation from Yahweh to Moshe. And let's take a look at what Yahusha said. And once again, this is Question in Paul on about page 58 and I believe. But before we do that, before we go to that verse, I want to add, I've added one since I talked to you earlier this afternoon, and added Matanyah 5, 17, 18, and 19. And I thought this was rather wonderful. Here is Yahusha speaking. He says, "You should not think or assume, you should not consider, expect, or suppose at any time, even the possibility of commonly held or popular establishment presumption, that I actually came, in fact appeared then, now, or in the future." That's what Arkomana Mei means. "To tear down, invalidate, put an end to, discard the Torah or the prophets. I actually came not to create a division, to dismiss, to invalidate, or to discard, but instead to completely fulfill." He's talking about the Moed Mikros. "Because in indeed and in truth, I say to you, until with absolute certainty the heaven and the earth cease to exist, not ever under any circumstance shall one aspect of the smallest letter," that's the Yod again, this is the one we were talking about earlier, "nor a single stroke of the pen," just a stroke of direction line making up a letter, "cease to be relevant from the Torah. Until with absolute certainty everything might take place. Therefore, whoever may at any time dismiss or attempt to do away with one of the smallest and least important of these prescriptions and instructions which are enjoined, and he may instruct or indoctrinate people in this manner, he will actually be provided the name that will be judicially and legally summed as little and lowly." What does polos mean in Latin?
Wow.
Little and lowly.
Little and lowly.
And he will be summed as that, little and lowly.
Right.
Conversely, he says, "And then whosoever might act upon it and teach it, this will properly be referred to and named great in importance among those who reign within the heavens." So you can obviously, which side of the fence he's leaning, hey, don't do this. But that was the verse that was interesting to me in regards to the letters. You know, he said, why do you change this? This is a big deal. That's not just a minor little thing that's changed over time we just do that now because it's our tradition. I beg your pardon?
Oh, that's ridiculous. It's offensive and it's basically infuriating. Calling Christianity is shattered to pieces right there by Yahusha.
Well, it also answers the question of who's the founder of Christianity.
Russia
has nothing to do with Christianity.
Well, of course not.
If you're following Yahusha, you have to be Torah observant. That's all he did. That's what he was, the Torah. He fulfilled parts of it, and whatever parts he could, in the sense of that it was his body, his soul, it went to Matzah and was restored on the Koram and adopted. There's no other option. That's what he did. So if Yahusha, the one they call Jesus mistakenly, was the founder of religion, and they say, well, what would Jesus do? Well, what would Jesus do if the name was Yosha? What would he do? First of all, he'd change his name back to Yosha.
He'd say call me Yosha.
Yeah.
Call me Yosha and follow the Torah.
And follow the Torah. That's what he said all the time.
Yeah. I mean,
so that alone, throws that out.
That's right. That alone throws it out the window.
Go ahead.
No. Excuse me.
I was just going to go on and continue just a tiny little bit. This then actually presently is the Torah under the auspices of free will. You all should choose at some point time to enter, personally engaged by moving through the narrow, specific, seldom tread and exacting door. Obviously, we're talking about the doorway to heaven. We're talking about Pesach, Passover. Broad, man-made and crafted to be wide open is the way which misleads and separates into utter destruction. And a great many are those who are influenced into moving while suffering the consequences of entering through it. There is only one door, and the Pesach door is narrow. Few will find it. You go in individually. You make a decision to accept the terms and conditions of the covenant. And one of those is, obviously, we celebrate the Moed Mikras and thank Yahweh for providing this wonderful gift for us, and we get to celebrate with Him. And the rest go to the wide path. The wide path is obviously religion.
That's right.
It goes on to stay through 7:14, and I'll just finish it here, and then we can chat a little bit if you wish. Certainly, the specific doorway has strict requirements, the mitzvah. It is narrow, seldom tread, and it is an exacting passageway, and it completely goes against the crowd to the point of persecution. Now, we all experience some of that. The one way which leads separating those guided unto life, but very few of those finding it. So to wrap it up, he addresses, there is, if this is Torah observant. This is a man who understands, obviously, the pathway, and he's going to be the one that provides the hard work of Passover. He is the lamb. So, it just can be no confusion about that. If you want to find the answer, there it is. Now, we still have a little bit of time tonight, and what I'd like to do in the kind of the fourth part of this, as far as areas to go, is to what I started with you when what I was reading when Craig asked me to do the show is Chabuk. And if you're not familiar with Chabuk, it is the most interesting book. There are two shows. Let me back up just a minute. There are two shows. Interesting. There's a pattern here. The first show was King Saul, King Shaul. Shaul means a place of separation from Yahweh. It is a place we think of as people use the term hell. It's not hell. It is a diminished to a zero dimension, something like a black hole. But it's a place where a soul would be alive and the consciousness would be alive. And you would question why you did what you did or why how you got there. But Shaul is what Shaul, that's what Shaul, the word, means. Paul's name was Shaul. The first Shaul was the king, and he gave us a king. Yahweh didn't want him to have a king. He said, I'm your father. You don't need a king. I'll take care of you. He'll give you an army, and you'll have to pay for the army. The army would take everything you've got. Once again, you won't be free. You realize, Jeff, that at that particular time, that was the only free society in the entire world.
Yes.
Until Shaul became king.
That's right. And they basically toss it away with by just talk to going away at all.
He gave him. He gave Samuel. He sent Samuel there, and he said, "Before you do this, and don't let them do it. But before you do this, here's 12 reasons why they should not do that."
Right.
So here's his first attack on Shaul, of the Shaul of politics and military. And he gives him 12 reasons why you can't, why you shouldn't rather do that. Don't do it. This is the result. He'll take your children. He'll take your money. You will work for the state. You'll work for the military. He will go off to war. Basically, they go off to war to steal stuff. Yahweh didn't need an army to go attack other people. He said, oh, you know, he put the fence up and protect you from anything that could come your way. They were going to be, if they lived their life according to the Torah, they would have plenty to eat, plenty to deal with, and a long life. The second Shaul follows that same little pattern. Yahweh sends the most significant thing about Shavuot's prophecy life is that he is shown Shaul, which is later called Paul. And that's the one who brought the most hideous and most popular religion in the history of the world. Has already captured at least or destroyed at least 5 billion souls. So this is probably, this was quite a stunning thing. There was a friend of ours named David in New Zealand, and he's the one that wrote to Craig and said, well, what about Paul? And that was what launched the early editions of Question Paul that we went through, and until it finally came to the book that we're using right now. And so let's take a little bit of a look at this. We have a little bit of time, and if you don't mind, I'm gonna read a little bit more. Towards you, Yahweh, there are cruel lies and a great injustice, a proliferation of errors which lead to death and destruction. So you must continually withhold salvation. That's from those who will follow him. Lies and injustice are conspicuous to me, and they are related. So he has been and continues to be contentious, taunting, quarrelsome, insulting. In this dispute, engaged in hostile opposition, offering an entirely different perception regarding the proper standard. Once again, he's attacking the mitzvah, ultimately putting man in conflict with God. And so strife and dissension, even argumentative objections, with regard to vindication, he advocates and promotes. So he's totally, this is obviously Paul, and he goes on to prove it without doubt because he calls him by name. So likewise, therefore, he has consistently incapacitated and genuinely paralyzed the purpose of the Torah, the source from which teaching, instruction, direction, and guidance flows. He failed to uplift and convey the glorious and eternal approach, the vindication whereby disputes are justly resolved, and we're talking about the Mishnah. For indeed, wickedness encompasses him, and guilt abounds, hemming in the hopeful in opposition to the righteous and the innocent. In this manner, his judgment regarding his ongoing means to vindication is perverted, distorted, and twisted, and false. And we go on to find that, of course, he's talking about faith in Jesus Christ and the gospel of the grace of grace of Jesus Christ. I know. Witness among the Gentiles, those who are actually observant and thoughtful are astonished and astounded, amazed and surprised that indeed a work will be, and now has been done in your days, that you will not find credible, even when it is written down and he is held accountable. When I looked at that the other day, I wrote a note, that's got to be our times. That's got to be this book I'm reading, Questioning Paul. Rather, look to me, paying attention to me, standing upright, established and restored against Chaldea, which is obviously a synonym for Babel, the corrupting, confusion of Babylon and the basis of Roman Catholicism, the country of heathens and pagans that is a disagreeable and poisonous, impetuous and senseless. He makes his way to the vast expanse of the world as if the world was his inheritance, taking possession of inhabitants places that are not his. You know, Paul certainly traveled around. And, of course, the Roman Catholic Church certainly traveled around, and so did the Protestant Church, which is just Catholicism light. terrible, dreadful, intimidating, this from his decision, the lofty status he sought, which he didn't get, because he became lowly and little, as he claims, because he chose that name, and the plan he advances and spreads. Chabok is probably one of the most exciting ones because he doesn't pull any punches and there's no way to argue this point on who he's talking about. It's only been two things
right.
Shall be. It's got to be a place. Places don't talk and run around. Or it's got to be a person. You only have two Shauls in the whole Torah, or mentioned in the whole Torah. One of them's a king, and he did political things, and another one, and we're talking about religious things now.
As you mentioned, Kirk, it's both. It's a person, and it's a place. And you just got to know the right context.
Yeah.
To be able to interpret it. But, yeah, little and lowly is absolutely right. What a name. And separation from Yah is exactly what it means. It was just a place, you know, separation from Yah. And plague of death is the fitting verdict for those who perpetuate. And
well, they do. It's a disease.
The message.
It encompasses everything, and I know you look. Obviously, you're American, and you live in a world that is dominated by Christian thought, but also being Yehudi, you are well aware of growing up with rabbinical types. I mean, I have close friends that were Jewish or Yehudi, or Yehudim. And I know what they think, and it was twisted to me. The Christian church was quite twisted to me. I just didn't know which way to go, and I chose a rather a Christian group that I thought was more scholarly and knew something, and was wrong. Thank God I found this. But it's hard. The influences are just overwhelming. I don't get mad at people because they don't see this, don't want to see this. I understand they're under just overwhelming pressure. It's hard to walk against the grain, you know, when everybody's going left and you want to go right. So,
absolutely. In fact, for many of us, and most of us, it's harder to unlearn than it is to relearn and learn correctly. It is, it is. You're absolutely right, Kirk.
Yeah.
But
that's JB's story. It was a lot easier for him because he grew up as a atheist or an agnostic at least, and so he didn't have to. He wasn't indoctrinated with all this stuff and trying to go, oh wow, that's wrong. It's hard not to cling on to some of that stuff.
Right.
Let me just finish this little part from 1:11, 12, and 13. This was that we finished off 1:11, 1:12, and it says, "And you are you not from eternity, an unlimited duration of time, Yahweh?" He's talking. This is Shabu talking to Yahweh. "My God, my set apart one, my Kodesh one. You cannot die and cannot be killed, Yahweh. Concerning this judgment is what you have appointed for him. And the rock can be either Shimon, Kepesh, Peter, or it can be Yosha. And the rock you have established to argue against and rebuke him, you have positioned and appointed him to prove that he, Shaul, Paul, is wrong, to chide him, to accuse him, and judge him." It's quite good context to use either one, because Shimon, Kepesh, had Paul come to Jerusalem, and basically they ran him off. So he argued against him. That was the big battle when I went to a church one time. They were having a battle discussion on this argument between Paul and Simon Peter, or Shimon Kepesh. And I kept saying to myself, this is long ago, in college. And I'm saying, why do they have to argue if they're all both apostles? They should be on the same page. And, you know, silly me. I didn't really, I thought a lot of these things. I just never explored them. But he's still the one who argued with him the most is Yahweh. And Yahusha, we just went through some of the verses that Yahusha claimed about him. And we just went through, we're going through now the things that Yahweh has told his prophet to say, or inspired his prophet to say. This is, by the way, is 666 years between the time Shavuot wrote this prophecy and the year that Paul, old good old Shavuot, wrote Galatians.
His first epistle, that's right. Interesting
yeah.
That's pretty,
there's a myth. There's a total myth if anybody finds it, yeah.
That's amazing. That is amazing. Wow.
He said, too flawless and clean are your eyes to witness such malignant and displeasing evil. You cannot endure to look upon or consider such grievous and perverse labors, this painful iniquity. I thought that was really interesting because most of us should be that way. We should be guarding, Yahweh, don't look at this. This is awful. I mean, Shavuot really, really had Yahweh's heart. You know, he's saying, this is just too perverse for you. You're too pure. You shouldn't even look at this. This is so disgusting. He says, well, why would you look at it or consider treacherous behavior that is neither trustworthy nor reliable? You are silent and still inactive, neither listening, speaking, nor taking action in devouring the wicked more righteous than him. This is really, Chabuk is really upset. He doesn't want to look at this. He's seen it. He thinks it's disgusting. He knows what the Torah says, obviously. And here's this guy, he's been, however this works, he's been transported in a way to see what he's saying and observe this scene and report it back. And even though this is going to be hundreds of years, 666 years before he arrives on the scene in a big way, Shavuot was seeing it and just he was livid.
Yeah.
So following the indicting introduction condemning Pauline Christianity, which it does, Yahweh confirmed that he isn't about to alter any of the requirements to participate in his covenant, and would change the approach that he has taken to facilitate our salvation by way of his invitations, his Moed Mikra. This alone is sufficient to prove that Yahweh's approach is in direct opposition to God. So if I can indulge y'all a little longer, we'll read a little bit more. Upon my requirements, he says, and responsibilities. That's Mishmerith, and I've translated that multiple times in the last few weeks. What it means is my mission, which functions and serves as a safeguard to watch over and preserve the observant, which is also from Shamar, to observe, closely examine, and carefully consider, retain one's focus. Or his focus in this case, it's in the first person, and my focus, Yahweh. I have decided I will literally, this is Yahweh talking, I will literally and continually stand, that's Ahmad, I will always be present. Let me give you the amplified here because this is pretty good stuff. I will always be present, actually standing and thereby genuinely enabling others to consistently stand. That's in the qual stem, addressing actual events which are to be interpreted literally, and the imperfect conjugation which reveals that God's presence will continue throughout time. Remember, the imperfect is ongoing. And in the cohortive expression, which is volitional, that has to be a desire in the first person. That means Yahweh wants to do this. He very, very, very much wants to stand and make his stand. And I will choose to always and stand and present myself as Yatsab, or Yatsab, I mean. I will consistently stand firm, dependable, and unchanging. You know, one of the things I looked up in the Yatsab was is to be like a wall. You know, steady as a wall, a protective barrier between you and any of your enemies or anything that would hurt you. I will consistently stand, Yatsab, dependable and unchanging. Well, if you're dependable and unchanging, then he ain't going to change. God alone is taking the stand. The imperfect conjugation reveals that his stand is consistent, continual, enduring throughout time, and in the cohortive form conveys that where and how he presents himself is of his choosing. So he goes on to say, and I will choose to always stand, present myself upon that which protects and fortifies. So then I will be on the lookout. This is pretty cool. I will be on the lookout in order to see what he will say about me. Oh, you think that he is? Well, that's Paul. But then how can I be expected to change my attitude, my thinking? This is Yahweh talking, or my response. Why should I reverse course and thereby mislead concerning my disapproving rebuke, my complaint, my correction, my reproof, and my strong disapproval, my rational arguments in response to subsequent punishment? Now, if you don't translate a little bit, you won't get as much out of that. And what I have found, probably in the last year, that where I was trying to get the context and just select the four or five things that could be in that context, I have spent a lot of time lately writing everything down that the word could mean. Because I'm surprised the more I look at it and the more I learn and understand that many of those things will apply. And that's why you can get such a... Now, it makes the reading a little long. Like instead of just disapproving rebukes, my complaint, correction, reproof, strong disapproval, my rational arguments to respond in subsequent punishment, all of that's in there on each one of these words. So digging deep gives you more stuff and a clearer understanding, because ultimately it's more about understanding these things. And that's a good endorsement for taking a little time to translate some of these things. Then Yahweh answered, approaching me, and he said, this is Shavuot talking, write this revelation and then expound upon and reiterate it using those letters upon writing tablets, so that by reciting this he might run and go away. It's a shame it didn't go away.
It's a shame it didn't go away.
It goes on, and I think if you're listening, it's quite a lot here to read. It's really a short prophecy, but it is probably the most important as far as understanding how y'all views religion, and in particular Paul, and in particular Christianity. He has no love for rabbinical Judaism as a religion either. He loves his Jewish people, but he's not. When they turn to religion, the same as anybody else, they're no longer him. He made that perfectly clear on his tablet of stone. So it's not. He likes me because I am whatever, or I'm a good person, or I'm a this. I mean, that's a total misconception. He likes the people who want to be part of his family and love his. That's why his approach to things, his desire for us to be family. What would you like to add? Because we're just talking among friends, filling in today.
I think it's important to just reemphasize the toxic nature of these popular counterfeits that have damned so many people, both on the rabbinic Judaism side and the appalling Christianity side, and then those who fall for both. I think it's imperative that the foundational principles which we've been elaborating on, the name, derivations of Yah's name, Yahosha's name, the essence and how important, how he views it and how he regards it, and the importance he places on it by what he has to say in the tablets of stone. Yeah, I mean, just know, closely observe, carefully consider Shema and Shamar, what the words Torah mean. I mean, just the whole message and essence of the Torah, and how loving and wonderful Yah is. Of course, He gives us so many opportunities to make up for our deficits and to correct our iniquities and to come back to the fold and to get to be right part of the family. You know, he gives us all so many opportunities, and He's always asking us, please come back, and please don't repeat the same mistake.
Mm-hmm.
As you discussed earlier, it's a loving father, a loving message, and a very consistent message.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're on the same page. These are foundational things. These are the things that I actually keep on my desk or near my desk all the time. And as a reminder, I just like to look at them, and then it all floods through. The beauty of it, as the world's going to get nastier and worse, as we know, as we get closer and closer in the next 10 years. But the one thing you can always hold close to your heart, is that there is no alternative to live eternally. There's only one way, there's only one door, there's only one path, and it goes through the Moed Mikri. So to finish this tonight, let me reiterate what we found out and when we were studying Abraham in the last few weeks, and those I like to keep in front of me as well. And those are the five conditions to joining the covenant family. And the first thing you have to do is, we all know, those who have been around a while, we know that we have to walk away from confusion, from Babel. That's man's religion, man's politics, man's military schemes, even the monetary schemes. Of course, we still have to deal with it, but we don't be part of it. They're all in conflict with Yahweh's word and Yahweh's plan. And that's what he says, and all of that is represented by Mithraim, or by Babel, or by the Canaanite religion, or the Roman Catholicism, or any religion. Trust and rely is the second condition of this covenant. Trust and rely on Yahweh's promises and teaching. The way I learned to think about Torah, and Torah doesn't mean law, it never does. They put it in some of the English dictionaries, obviously, to support their God, their Lord. But it always means teaching. In fact, I always use a little four-letter thing that says, it's good, or ITGD is instruction, teaching, guidance, and direction. And that's what the whole Torah is. Read it that way. Read it for understanding, and so that you can rely on those promises and teachings. The third condition, of course, is carefully consider the terms and conditions on behalf of Yahweh's offer. And those are the mitzvah. And those become the pathway. This also becomes the, in order to become perfect, tzedek, to be seen as perfect by Yahweh, to be covered by the Ruach Kodesh and the light. You do that, and our path that we walk through, of course, is the seven Moed Mikras that we get to celebrate, and hopefully very soon, maybe this fall, we can all get together. I know you're in different parts, we're in different parts of the country, but we'll get together and celebrate together, where we can call, read and recite God's word for those Moed Mikra meetings. And then, of course, the fifth one was that parents are to circumcise their sons as a way to remember this agreement. And so there's the five, and all of them, you cannot be a Christian and accept those. That's the tragedy. Paul's against every one of those things. The church is against every one of those things. Name one that they like. None. I mean, I remember reading what was it, Maimonides and all these 600 and whatever things to do or not do.
613 mitzvot.
And then there's like 10 planks or something, or 12 planks or 15 planks or something.
Oh.
And the only one he's got right is God is one. Well, God is one.
Please.
Everything else, you know, huh?
Yeah.
Nothing came out of the door. So, any case.
Like you said, instruction, guidance, teaching, and indirection.
There's yeah.
No law.
Yeah,
that's right. I mean, that's just a total corruption of the term that it should be done away with. My goodness.
Well, in any case,
you know, you've covered a lot of material tonight.
So it would get too dry right to the end. You know, it would be fun sometime. If he asks us to do this again, we'll jump on board with the rest of Shavuot, because it is a death blow to Paul.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, the question, Paul, if that's all you read out of question, Paul, you couldn't stay a Christian. I mean, I don't know how you would reconcile some of these things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so black and white. This Yahweh's here, they're there.
It's irreconcilable if you are rational and if you give credence to evidence and logic and Shavuot really takes Paul to task, as there's so many other prophets and prophecies, but he really goes after him in a big way, and it's amazing the way the timing is with the, he penned his words.
Mm-hmm. His first letter.
666 years before the Galatians was written, which is the plague of death, Magna Carta. Initial claim to fame.
Very good. Yeah.
It's just amazing the way that timing is. But,
well, we'll review in case of somebody new. The last little thing where we got just a few more minutes left, and just we'll review the the seven Moed Mikras, and when we were talking about those, if you've a new listener, of course there's these are a celebratory feast. There are only seven of them. The menorah has seven candle holders, not nine. They don't make up more. He started with seven. He only needs seven. And, of course, that's Pesach and Matzah and Bukkurim, where we were adopted. The first one satisfies the releases the soul through death. And the Matzah cleanses the soul. And then through Bukkurim, we're allowed to be enlightened. And then Shavuah is when we are enlightened and we are empowered, so that we can tell this story. So thank you so much, Jeff, for being here. I appreciate you joining me.
Oh, it's been fun. It's been fun. I appreciate spending this time with you and the rest of the family. And thank you for all the work that you have done. Thank you for all that you do have done, continue to do. Please give a Shabbat Shalom to me from your lovely bride.
Yeah.
And I look forward to spending time with you.
Okay, me too. And sooner the better. All right, my friend, we'll be talking soon. And good night, y'all. And we will see you again next week. CW should be here and with bells on. So there we go.
Yes.
Shalom. Shalom.
Shalom. Shalom. Shalom. Shalom.